Hello and welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is James Bosworth, a columnist at World Politics Review and the founder of Hexagon, a consulting firm performing political risk analysis. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You recently argued that the surge of immigration that the U.S. has seen at its southern border is caused by push rather than pull factors. Push factors being those kind of local hardships that motivate people to leave their countries and head for the U.S., whereas pull factors refer to the attractiveness of the U.S. labor market, the opportunity for substantially higher wages, and so on. Today, we're going to explore the goings-on in our own hemisphere to see if we can illuminate some of these push factors that are contributing to the surge at the border and explore Biden's overall approach to the region. To open things up, before I start asking about specifics, I want to give you an opportunity to just tell us what you think of Biden's general approach to this region. Broadly speaking, how would you characterize this administration's policies?
So I'm relatively supportive of this administration's policies. I'm happy to put my cards on the table in terms of that. I find them to have been very opportunistic in terms of taking advantage of specific moments to have success, but they have not stretched to try to get success where opportunity hasn't arisen. Let me put a couple examples to that, right? So if you go back and you look at the transition that occurred in Honduras, where Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had stolen the previous election, lost the election. And you know, they pushed for a transition of power. They received one. Hernandez was eventually extradited to the United States and tried on drug trafficking charges. Very successful. I mean, we could look at Honduras right now and talk about problems that are occurring there, but it's far better that there was a democratic transition, a democratically elected president there, than have someone who had been bribed by the Sinaloa cartel. You can look at Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro had attempted, plotted some sort of coup. The Biden administration really pushed to make sure that the coup did not occur and that the democratic transition had happened. And then similarly, Guatemala being the amazing example that occurred last year. I mean, the Biden administration wasn't doing much prior to the first round. But as soon as the opportunity existed in which Bernardo Arevalo had the opportunity to become president, they kicked it up into high gear. And they really, you know, made an effort to make sure that the election was done properly and that the democratic transition happened. All of those are really great examples. And at the same time, those are the examples, right? There's not like, you can go across the region and also see places where they've been less engaged. And I don't want to mean to say less engaged in terms that, I mean, there's always people working issues across all of Latin America, right? But from that very high level point of view, they have, you know, they've gone in and dealt with these situations when they've had the opportunities. But say, Cuba policy hasn't really moved. Venezuela policy, I mean, they're engaged in it, but you know, they haven't found that moment in which they can flip a switch and change things, and so they really haven't taken any risks on Venezuela policy. Those sorts of issues, I think, you know, where they've been opportunistic, it's an important sort of distinction for them, right? It's seen as sort of a limited use of U.S. power. You know, find the opportunities where we can have influence, and step back from the places where maybe we don't have the day to day, you know, where we don't have the same level of influence that we might be able to, and don't stretch, don't make a mistake, don't reach too far and then make a mistake, right? And this goes back to, I think, where President Obama's policies were as well. So that's how I view the overall situation. I can also just real quick define a difference between Latin America policy and migration policy. And you know, and I and many others, we can differ in terms of how we view Latin America policy. And we, you know, I think there's been a lot of positives. There's a few negatives, but overall, the balance is positive. Migration policy, nobody's happy with, right? There's nobody who thinks migration policy is going well right now, right? People on the right are convinced that migration policy is doing quite poorly because we have this surge at the border, and they'd like to see a crackdown. People on the left are upset that Biden didn't keep his campaign promises, and that Biden, you know, isn't treating migrants more humanely, and that migration processing isn't going correctly. And people who are sort of centrist technocrats just see a mess at the border and are wondering, well, why aren't you fixing it? You know, whatever the situation is. And so, you know, there's a difference here between Latin America policy, even though they've tried to make a connection between the broader sort of root causes in Latin America and migration. There's a real difference between having some success in Latin America policy but not having success at the border. And it may speak to failures of U.S. policy, but it may also speak to the fact that maybe the U.S. can't fix it, right? I mean, it is possible that the United States can't control the fact that there is a big push situation coming out of the region, and there's a big pull factor inside the United States, and the difference between the conditions in certain countries and the conditions in the United States is going to drive people no matter what the policies are.
Excellent. I'll be pulling on a number of those threads, but I want to ask you about our immediate neighbor to the south, Mexico. President López Obrador has reportedly settled into a kind of acceptance or even implicit cooperation with drug cartels, which control increasingly large swaths of territory in both northern and southern Mexico now. He's even recently indicated that he won't really respond that well to pressure to do Washington's bidding, including on dealing with the gangs. He was quoted as saying, "We are not going to act as policemen for any foreign government," which I understand has prompted the Biden administration to regard him as an unreliable partner. Can you just talk about the political dynamics in Mexico, what's going on there, and how that's informed U.S.-Mexico relations?
Sure. When López Obrador was elected back in 2018, you know, his slogan at the time was "Abrazos, no balazos," right? Right, hugs, not bullets. And, you know, he had this dynamic in which he was planning to, or he campaigned on, changing security policy overall. He was going to reduce the use of the military. He was going to increase social spending. And he's going to stop the sort of the offensive against the drug cartels that was partially driving the violence in Mexico. It's not just the government offensive. The drug cartels are somewhat to blame for the violence, but, you know, he was going to change strategy to try to fix Mexico. López Obrador was elected, and within the first 100 days, you could see that he was not following the strategy that he put forward in his campaign. Abrazos, no balazos didn't exist. There were not a lot of hugs, and there were a lot of bullets. And the fact is, you know, López Obrador fell in love with the military. Classic populist sort of autocrat decided that, you know, it wasn't that he didn't want the military to be involved. It's that he wanted the military to be more involved inside of security, inside of migration, inside of infrastructure issues. We have not seen a president militarize Mexico this way in over a century. And you know, that aspect of it is important because López Obrador hasn't fixed the security situation, but he has brought the military more into the government. To the security situation, López Obrador's policies have not been particularly clear in terms of who he's fighting at any given time, which drug cartels, what he thinks should happen with drug cartels. This sort of carefully outlined policy, and you can go back to 2017, 2018, see these policies that were very carefully thought through by López Obrador and his advisors. Once he got into power, those did not occur. And it's not clear what his policy is, other than to claim credit for whatever limited successes have occurred and to avoid, you know, damage as it's occurred, right? This is a president who does not want to take the blame for anything that goes wrong and wants to take the credit for everything that goes right. The Biden administration doesn't view him as a credible partner because he's not, right? I mean, and the fact is, you know, I think the General Cienfuegos issue sort of illustrates this, and I would recommend viewers go and look up the New York Times article that sort of outlined what happened with Cienfuegos. But you know, this was a corrupt general in Mexico who had taken bribes from a drug cartel. The sort of person who López Obrador, you know, when he was in the opposition, would have said, "Hey, this person should be prosecuted and convicted." When Cienfuegos was detained in the United States, López Obrador turned and, you know, shut down all cooperation with the United States and made sure that Cienfuegos was returned back to Mexico. And this occurred under the previous U.S. administration, but this incident sort of demonstrated that López Obrador had created this connection with the military and really did not want to crack down on corruption or drug cartels in the way that he had promised to. It becomes hard to deal with somebody who isn't particularly clear with his policies. And the Biden administration, when Donald Trump was president in the United States, López Obrador and Donald Trump got along quite well because Donald Trump is fairly transactional, so is López Obrador. And so they were able to sort of cut deals with each other. And Biden is less transactional than Trump. I think everybody across the political spectrum would sort of agree with that. And you know, Biden isn't cutting the deals with López Obrador. And López Obrador still wants to have that leverage. López Obrador knows he has leverage in U.S. political situation due to the migration issue. It is a top issue among so many U.S. voters, the top issue in the media. And, you know, he expects the Biden administration to sort of move, you know, to do some of his bidding so that he gets what he wants on the, you know, in terms of trade or in terms of economics or just in terms of attention. And in return, you know, he may, you know, crack down on migration from time to time. This sort of, you know, López Obrador wants the transactional relationship and Biden doesn't necessarily want that. And I think that that's a divide between the two countries that has created friction and made it difficult for the two presidents to really get along. And I do want to step back for a second and say, I mean, I can point at this. I mean, this, you know, Biden and López Obrador is not Biden and Putin, right? You know, I mean, we get along really well with Mexico, right? I'm pointing at a friction that is occurring, but it's not like we are rivals or antagonists, right? There's still a lot of cooperation that occurs between the two countries. I can point at this as a very source of friction, but at the same time, we have a great relationship with both of our neighbors, and the United States should be very grateful to have Canada and Mexico's neighbors because it is a very big source of U.S. power. So having said all my criticisms, I do want to highlight, like, this isn't as bad as it could be.
I totally get it. I wonder if I can follow up on, I read a little bit about the fact that criminal organizations are exploiting the migrant situation, particularly in Mexico, to kind of offer safe passage for people, typically at exorbitant prices, and that the Mexican government kind of looks away at this. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah. I mean, migrants have it hard, right? And it's, I mean, they flee their countries, whatever country it is, oftentimes for a variety of reasons, right? Everyone wants to go, well, is it political persecution or economics? And a lot of times it's both, right? I mean, people are living a very hard life. Economically, they're looking for opportunities. At the same time, I mean, they could be persecuted by drug cartels. They could be persecuted by the government, right? The situation in Venezuela, for instance, where 7 million people have fled Venezuela at this point, right? Some of it is government persecution. Some of it's the fact that the economy collapsed in Venezuela. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people flee. But they've lived a hard life. The reason they're leaving is because life is not good where they are. And then across the route, they're exploited. And in Mexico, I can get to Mexico in a second, but I mean, this is true in Northwest Colombia, where the Clan del Golfo makes big profits moving migrants across Colombia and into the Darien Gap. It's true for criminal groups across Central America. And then, yes, they get to Mexico. And I mean, many of these Mexican criminal organizations, I mean, we call them drug cartels, but they're not. Drugs is just one business that they're in. They're also into human smuggling and human trafficking and wildlife trafficking and extortion and, you know, counterfeit pharmaceuticals. I mean, they have a range of businesses and they make a lot of money human smuggling and extorting migrant communities. The Mexican government doesn't just look away. I mean, from this. The Mexican government actively punishes migrants at times by deporting migrants from northern Mexico to southern Mexico to make them do the trip again and have to experience the situation of being extorted and exploited by the cartels over again. And what the migrants will tell you is, yes, the cartels do all this, but so do the Mexican security forces. Many of them have had to pay bribes to Mexican police officers or Mexican military officers. It is an exploitative system. Migrants get kidnapped and then their relatives are called and asked to pay hostage payments. I mean, it is a terrible process to have to make it through Mexico and sometimes to have to make it through Mexico multiple times in order to get to the border and then get treated by the United States, however they're treated, which is certainly better than they're treated in Mexico, but still could be far better inside the United States as well. I mean, it is a tough process for them from the moment they are in their country all the way up through the United States. It's not an easy process by any means.
What's going on in Haiti? The UN recently referred to the gang violence and political instability there as a cataclysmic situation. I think Prime Minister Ariel Henry resigned, and I believe it fled, even as the US provided some $10 million worth of weapons and equipment to Haitian security forces. Can you explain what's been happening there?
It is a long, complicated, multi-year failure that has occurred. But you know, to Ariel Henry, it was it is in the process of resigning, I guess I would say. It's the long process. Henry was never elected, right? And I think that that's a really important aspect to this. I mean, he became the prime minister right as the previous president was assassinated. And then, you know, managed to become sort of the interim president. But then every single politician in Haiti who was elected has had their term up, including the presidency. No new elections have been held. It's a political disaster in the sense that, you know, as I wrote recently, right, democracies have elections because that's what defines being a democracy. Dictatorships have elections because they believe in doing so, because it's part of the process of creating the illusion of legitimacy for a dictatorship. And then there's Haiti, which hasn't had an election. It's the one country that just can't hold an election at all, either fake or real, because of the lack of institutionality. In this process, MINUSTAH, which was the previous UN peacekeeping force, pulled out years ago. The gang violence really increased, and the gangs became critical political actors in Haiti. And there are a number of gangs that have begun working with each other. There's a couple gang clashes that occur, but the gangs are the key political actors in the country right now, as the government has lost all legitimacy. And the gangs, as the group that has the monopoly on violence in Haiti, believe they have a right to have some say in the country's political future. And in the process, they've engaged in kidnapping, extortion, they've gone after critical infrastructure, and they've taken over at times ports and roads that are critical to moving food and fuel across the country. For anybody who wants to deal with Haiti right now, they have a problem, because who do you talk to? It's a totally illegitimate government at the moment. So the international community is trying to create a transition council to govern Haiti. But what legitimacy does that council have? Does the Haitian population view it as legitimate? At some point, there have to be elections in Haiti just so we can say, okay, we're dealing with this actor or this actor. The United States and others don't want to deal with Barbecue, who's one of the key gang leaders, right? I mean, he's not somebody who we want to deal with, but he's a warlord of sorts who does control territory and is a key political actor. And at some point, he's going to be involved in these negotiations. I think the United States, I mean, there's no easy solution to Haiti. I worry because there's sort of a Hail Mary pass right now of, hey, we're going to bring in a peacekeeping force involving Kenyan police to try to solve some of these problems. You know, the peacekeeping force being proposed is smaller than the previous peacekeeping force, and there's no peace to keep. The previous peacekeeping force was able to come in, and yes, there were problems, but they were able to sort of deal with them one-on-one. At this point, the violence today is 10x what the violence was 20 years ago. Bringing in a smaller force to try to deal with that level of violence and gangs who have become heavily politicized, who aren't just gangs in the sense that they're neighborhood gangs, but are gangs that have national ambition to influence the politics of the country. It's going to take a much bigger effort in terms of resources and personnel. Does that involve the U.S.? Probably, but it can't just be the U.S. The U.S. has a terrible history of intervening in Haiti. It's going to take the United States and Canada and France and probably a good portion of Latin America and the Caribbean somehow cooperating with each other. And nobody wants to do it, right? Because this is not a project where you go in and you succeed. This is a project where you go in and you struggle for 10 or 20 years. Nobody wants to put it out that way, but that's what it is. And so everybody's sort of putting off entering Haiti because they know that you don't go into Haiti and succeed. You go into Haiti and then you fail for years and years on end just trying to make the situation slightly better. And that's not a great place to be operating from.
Let's move to Venezuela. The U.S. is obviously crosswise with the Maduro regime. Trump initiated a so-called maximum pressure campaign on Venezuela, imposing steep economic sanctions, which largely remain in place. I think you kind of referenced the Biden administration's unchanging approach here. There have been some speculations about a potential military invasion of neighboring Guyana over territorial claims in an oil-rich region there. Biden has attempted to deter this by signaling that we would intervene if it happens. Meanwhile, things are bad enough in Venezuela that there's quite a bit of emigration out of there. Can you talk about the state of things in Venezuela and how Washington has been handling it?
Sure. I mean, the Chavistas have been in power now since the late 1990s. It's not as if there were great policies under President Bush or President Obama or President Trump or President Biden, right? You can see shifts in policies over time, and there have been. And at the same time, Chavez died because of cancer. And then Maduro has been in power for the 10 years since. And no U.S. policy, whether it's been maximum pressure of sanctions or sanctions relief and negotiations, has really helped, right? In recent months, the Biden administration, late 2023, Biden administration did offer some sanctions relief as part of a package in which some prisoners were exchanged. And the Maduro regime agreed to free and fair elections, though we all sort of know that it's not going to be free and fair, right? But at least, potentially improve the election conditions in some way, shape, or form. It's not succeeding, right? I mean, as we are recording this right now in early April, the elections are being manipulated, and everyone's sort of calling for the Biden administration to return to the previous sanctions policy. But we're in a weird situation. The previous sanctions policy failed. The dropping of sanctions failed. So going back to sanctions isn't going to succeed either. And this is a really tough situation where, as I sort of referenced earlier, I mean, the Biden administration is sort of hitting the limits of U.S. power here, right? It's not as if there is some other solution where if the U.S. just implemented this sanction or did this policy that all of a sudden everything would change and Venezuela would improve. They are trying their best to use U.S. influence. They're finding sort of they're hitting a limit. There's only so much the United States can do. Referencing Guyana, that is something that the Biden administration has done. They have set I don't think this is the official policy, but it's the unofficial policy everyone recognizes. They set a hard red line and told Venezuela they cannot invade Guyana. And there have been regular visits from key administration officials going down to Guyana. And Venezuela continues upping the rhetoric on this, but a lot of Venezuela's rhetoric on Guyana is about Venezuelan domestic politics. They are using the Guyana issue to try to mobilize voters, though that's not working. They're also using the Guyana issue to sort of repress their political opponents, right? So actually a law that was recently passed said that if anyone uses the old map of Venezuela that doesn't recognize the portion of Guyana territory, that they could be potentially arrested or banned from being political candidates. A lot of it's about domestic politics, but the Biden administration does want to make clear, Venezuela cannot invade Guyana. That is the red line. And arguably the United States does have the ability. I mean, that is the one thing that we could set a red line on and follow through on. Should it ever be necessary. But beyond that sort of Guyana issue, U.S. influence in Venezuela is somewhat limited at the moment. We could re-implement sanctions. We could lift sanctions. Doesn't really matter. I mean, that's the really tough thing, I think, for people to hear, is that the U.S. can only do so much right now. A lot of it is about how the opposition unites or doesn't unite. And part of it is about how Venezuela's neighbors react in terms of Colombia and Brazil. The U.S. only can do so much, and we need Venezuela's neighbors and other actors to sort of take the correct steps in order to get a better policy here.
Absolutely. I think one of the worst features of Washington's foreign policy is they don't like to hear that we don't have a lot of tools to manipulate situation A, B, or C. It's always, there's got to be some right policy that we can find, as opposed to just, actually, we don't have much in our toolbox to address this. Next, I want to ask about Cuba. Obviously, the U.S. has a long-standing and failed policy of isolation towards Cuba. Obama tried to loosen that up a little bit. Trump reversed it. Biden has sort of reverted to the status quo. It's clearly not a priority to thaw relations. But in the last few years, the repression and political instability there has increased. And as I understand, there's been a surge of Cubans trying to get into the U.S. as a result. Is that right?
Absolutely. The economic and political situation in Cuba has deteriorated. Somewhere between 3% and 5% of the country's population has fled just in the post-COVID era. It's a stunning amount of people who have left Cuba. I mean, Cuba, which has had waves of emigration over the years, is seeing another wave. And part of it is just because there is an economic collapse going on. I mean, Cuba has been blessed, I will say, though potentially cursed, by allies who have protected it over the years, whether that's the Soviet Union or Venezuela, back when Venezuela was flush with oil. And nobody's really protecting Cuba today. Nobody, and Cuba's held out on its own. Russia's not helping them. China's not really helping them. Venezuela doesn't have the resources to help them anymore. And so you're seeing things like power failures in Cuba. You're seeing issues in terms of fuel shortages in Cuba. Some of this is, you know, caused by natural disasters. Some of this is caused by a big fire that occurred a number of months ago at a key oil facility. But Cuba is struggling economically. The Biden administration hasn't really changed policy, but Cuba hasn't been a focus for them, right? And part of it is, the politics in the United States aren't particularly in favor of changing U.S.-Cuba policy, right? Everybody's focused in some ways on Venezuela or other issues across the hemisphere, and the urgency to change Cuba policy isn't there. If the Biden administration tries to crack down further on Cuba, they will alienate allies in Latin America. If the Biden administration tries to lift some of the restrictions that are currently exist on U.S. policy towards Cuba, they're going to face pushback in the United States Congress from doing that, right? And it's going to hurt their other agenda items. And so just sort of ignoring the Cuba issue for right now is unfortunately the most pragmatic thing for them to do. At some point, if the Biden administration gets a second term, they will probably address Cuba policy. It will probably look closer to what the Obama administration's policy is. But so far, term one, nothing's really changed in terms of what Biden has done towards Cuba.
You've referred to what's been happening in Ecuador as a security crisis. Again, it's more problems of drug gangs and poor governance issues. And you've written that the gangs have kind of graduated from having merely economic priorities to having political priorities, which I suspect has the tendency to intensify things.
Yeah. So earlier, I mean, Ecuador is on a long-term decline of a security situation, right? Over the last 4 years, no country in the hemisphere has seen the number of homicides increase as much as Ecuador has. Some of it is driven by local gang dynamics in terms of gangs fighting each other. And some of it is about the key Mexican cartels, the Sinaloa cartel and the CJNG, sort of fighting a proxy war within Ecuador among the various Ecuador gangs. Earlier this year, the gangs really ramped up the levels of violence. I think a lot of people saw the situation where the gangs took over the TV studio while the TV was live on air and held hostages there. The new government in charge, the President Noboa, has instituted a state of emergency. We've seen some progress in Ecuador in the last month or two, but at the same time, gangs continue to target key political figures, right? Mayors or prosecutors, which signals that this isn't just about local control of neighborhoods. It's not about extortion and making some money from drug trafficking, right? I mean, if you're targeting key prosecutors, you know, national level prosecutors, you're targeting mayors, you are trying to influence the political situation. This is one of those situations where, you know, I do think the United States has provided some aid to Ecuador, but nobody within the administration is talking about, you know, sort of a plan Ecuador, something that would really reshape U.S. security assistance towards Ecuador to try to solve the problem. In part because, there's just not the bandwidth given all the other global challenges that exist right this second. I think that, you know, in the next year, there's going to be a question about whether President Noboa can obtain the resources and sort of make his current security drive more sustainable. And there's going to be a question about what the gangs do to fight back, right? The gangs at the moment seem to have stepped back just a little bit from the levels of violence that were occurring in January. But it's not unthinkable that the gangs may try to do a brand new push to engage in violence or try to influence the political situation, especially because Ecuador is going to have yet more elections next year. This is going to be a shortened presidential administration for Noboa. And so, you know, the gangs are going to have, you know, anytime elections occur, you're going to see gang violence increases, they try to influence election outcomes. We saw that last year with Colombia's regional elections. We're seeing it right now with Mexico's elections, where the cartels are taking on some of the local politicians. And there was just a mayoral candidate murdered in Mexico last week, right? Gangs, when elections occur and gangs have political intentions, then drug gangs or cartels will get involved in the political situation and violence occurs against politicians.
At World Politics Review recently, you wrote that, quote, many Latin American countries are dealing with similar challenges from gangs that threaten governance and stability at the national level. But because these gangs aren't worried about sovereign borders, you say, quote, if every country tries to deal with its own gang and violence problems internally, they will fail one by one. And you go on to offer an appeal for regional cooperation, which you've mentioned before. What kind of regional cooperation would actually help mitigate these gang problems, since they span, you know, many different countries across the region?
Well, I mean, let's start with, what I just talked about with Ecuador, the fact that we know that a good portion of Ecuador's violence is driven by a proxy war between the Sinaloa cartel and the CJNG. And these proxy wars, whether it's those two cartels out of Mexico or the PCC out of Brazil, or the recent gang that's been spreading out of Venezuela, all of these countries are seeing a set of transnational criminal actors who are operating in the hemisphere. First off, they could just share intelligence, right? I mean, the idea that they could try to cooperate to share intelligence and then crack down on transnational trafficking on the back end in terms of money flows. These drug gangs, while they do now have more political motives, they exist for a profit, right? They all want to make money. You're never going to actually seize enough cocaine to crack down on the drug flows, but you can go after their money. And, you know, the United States has attempted to do so and at times has done so quite effectively. But if you don't have cooperation among the countries in Latin America, if Colombia and Argentina aren't talking to each other because currently their presidents are fighting it out on Twitter against each other, it's going to be hard for the two countries to cooperate on any sort of drug trafficking or criminal nexus that may occur, right? And that's just to give one example of an area where, you know, if we've seen, you know, Colombia and Mexico both have rejected the president of Peru, Boluarte, out of a political dispute that happened a year ago. If you're having presidents arguing with each other, they're not going to be cooperating on security issues. So I think just starting with intelligence sharing and some cooperation among the militaries in the region could do a lot to help this situation. But I think it's also political will, learning best practices from each other in terms of how police forces could operate or how militaries could operate. I think everyone needs to sort of question, you know, why certain countries have seen securities improve, why certain countries have seen securities decline, and then go at that, you know, try to learn from each other. And I think finally, I mean, one of the biggest problems that Latin America faces is the prison systems. Prison systems end up not holding the gangs accountable. They serve as recruitment mechanisms for the gangs, but no president gets elected on prison reform, right? You don't get elected because voters don't want to see prisoners treated better. But we do need more humane prisons in Latin America. We need prisons that can effectively rehabilitate the prisoners who can be rehabilitated and hold the prisoners who can't be rehabilitated. We need a regional system that sort of starts looking at how prison reform can happen and starts giving some of these presidents and leaders political cover to say, okay, this is actually a critical issue where we need to put funds and put money. Nobody wants to spend their tax dollars on better prisons, but the reality is Latin America needs that right now if they're going to, you know, include better judicial processes, better prisons for, you know, if they're going to hope to solve some of these gang issues long term.
If we just step back from the specifics of any of these countries and think about the common factor of drug cartels and criminal gangs, they're all over the place in this region. And there's probably a long history about why. And I know you've said that they've begun to take on new economic prerogatives and even political ones. But I wonder how drug prohibition in the United States and the various ways that the United States has tried to bolster international enforcement of that prohibition, often by further militarizing things, may have contributed to such a systemic problem across the region.
I mean, unfortunately, you know, for a long time in the United States, you know, drug policy was the fact that American citizens were dying of meth or today fentanyl. And so the United States spends a bunch of time interdicting cocaine in Latin America while we debate marijuana policy publicly. You know, we're fighting not one drug war here, right? The idea that we talk about drug prohibition, right? And marijuana is on the track to be legalized in the United States, and it's ridiculous to put it in the same sort of sentence as cocaine or fentanyl. Cocaine is an incredibly profitable drug. In fact, if you look at like how the cartels across Latin America make money, cocaine is just where the profits are for a lot of this. And it, actually, they make nowhere near the amount of money off fentanyl that they do off of cocaine. And fentanyl is what's killing people in the United States. You know, I mean, the reason that over 100,000 people died of drug overdoses last year is almost completely due to fentanyl. We're seeing a level of deaths from drugs in the United States that we've never seen previously. And I find it frustrating when the United States decides that it's going to continue pushing things like aerial eradication of coca plants in Latin America, or and the U.S. puts out press releases talking about how many tons of cocaine it sees. People aren't dying from cocaine in the United States. And so it becomes a real challenge for U.S. policy, because we talk about the drug war. Well, there's an argument that maybe fentanyl is a drug worth fighting a war against, but most of the other drugs are not. And you know, we need to pick and choose our battles much more carefully around the region if we want to be successful in both securing Latin America and in preventing overdose deaths in the United States. An argument that I made years ago, and I stand by, is that we really need to just define what we see as a measure of success, right? And for me, in the United States, it would be reduced overdose deaths. And in Latin America, it would be reduced homicides from and reduced influence of these various criminal organizations. And then we need to work towards that. But when we define success by how many tons of a drug we interdict, we're creating sort of a problem within our own policies, in the sense that we're just encouraging criminal groups to find better ways to traffic, to produce and traffic drugs. And in some ways, we're just increasing profit margins on the drugs that get through. We're sort of our own worst enemy in that process. And so we do want to very carefully define what we view as success and what we view as failure when we're dealing with drug policy. And you know, there are other things that we need to deal with, right? I mean, there is a river of guns coming from the United States into Mexico, right? And you can't prohibit guns any easier than you can prohibit drugs, right? I mean, there's a real, it's not like you can just flip a switch and say, well, you know, you will create your own black market problems that way. But there are certainly more that the United States could do to crack down on certain illicit firearms smuggling that occurs from the United States into Mexico. And there are aspects in which U.S. law enforcement needs to go after straw purchasers. Ultimately, though, it's not, you know, there's no sort of magic button policy that works for any of this. It's not as if prohibition and legalization, there's no magic wand of legalization that suddenly ends the drug war, right? Criminal groups aren't going to be like, oh, I guess, you know, cocaine is now legalized, I'll go into legal businesses. No, I mean, criminal groups make plenty of money off of extortion and migrant smuggling and other crimes. You're going to have criminal groups that you're going to have to deal with. Improving rule of law in Latin America, reducing corruption in Latin America, reducing corruption in the United States as well, is critical to actually solving these problems. There's no sort of magic solution on the prohibition legalization scale that does this on its own.
As we've said, the U.S. can't really address these various problems in a way that will obviously and directly mitigate the crisis at the border, as it's been called. We don't have a magic wand to stabilize and fix the deep and complicated problems across the region, and therefore strike the immigration problem at its root, so to speak. The more direct route to policy solutions on immigration policy, I think, is just U.S. domestic immigration policy, namely liberalizing and simplifying the system to enable higher levels of legal immigration, which is a net benefit, and then there won't be a surge of attempted illegal entries. But in foreign policy, which is what this show is about, the U.S. has had a tendency to put excessive resources into Asia and Europe and the Middle East, and sort of thinks of Latin America last, available to receive what's left over of U.S. time and resources in focus. What are some ways that are sort of specific things that we could do region-wide that would be good for these problems or just worth doing in general regarding the migrant problem?
Right. Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of saying like Latin America oftentimes is left behind. And I mean, I know that, you know, every administration in the past 40 years would tell you, no, we really care about Latin America. But Latin America, one of the problems Latin America policy has is it's afraid of the B word. And by B, I mean billions. And nobody wants to talk about more government spending. But when we talk about U.S. policy towards places like Pakistan or Israel, or, you know, Ukraine, right now, right, we're talking about billions of dollars, right? There's there's a over $100 billion package going through the U.S. Congress that's going to help with Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel, right? And then they get to Latin America and they're like, here, have $25 million for this policy, right? Nobody wants to address the B word, which is billions. One of the things that Plan Colombia got right, Plan Colombia was the policy that the United States government had in Colombia in the early 2000s that really stabilized the country, helped stabilize the country. It was not the only policy. Colombia deserves the vast majority of the credit for having successfully countered the criminal groups that were there, reduced the number of homicides, reduced the numbers of kidnappings. But U.S. policy played a really significant role in helping Colombia do this. And it did a couple of things. First off, it gave a long-term commitment to Colombia over multiple years. It wasn't just trapped by the U.S. budget cycle in which, you know, we delay our kick our budget down the road for 6 months via continuing resolutions and then barely pass it out of Congress and then start arguing about it again, right? They gave over a 10-year commitment to Colombia. And secondly, they gave billions of dollars to Colombia, right? This wasn't some sort of small change exercise that went into Colombia. And third, we didn't commit large numbers of troops, right? If you look at Afghanistan or Iraq, where tens of thousands of U.S. troops were there, in Colombia, there were never more than 800 U.S. military personnel on the ground at any time in this process. And sort of that combination of long-term commitment, big commitment, but not just the U.S. rolling in with its military trying to solve it, made a difference in Colombia. And I do think that is a practical model to start looking at other countries in the region where, you know, if you wanted to solve the problems in Haiti or Ecuador, they're not easy to solve, or Venezuela. None of it, I'm not going to suggest any of it's easy to solve, or you could just throw money at it and solve it, but you're not going to solve it on the cheap, right? There's no solution in Latin America. And to the U.S. national security priorities, I will make the case that security in Mexico, Guatemala, Colombia, and Venezuela is more important than what happens in the Middle East or what happens in Europe for the United States security. And the U.S. needs to be able to put Latin America on the same terms that it puts the Middle East or Europe or Asia if it really wants to deal with its national security situation.
James Bosworth, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.